Hey, what's going on? Welcome to the Mile High Five podcast. I'm Doug Cunnington, and today I'm going to chat with Josh Epley. How are you doing today?
Hey, Doug. I'm honored to be here. Thanks for having me. I'm doing great. How are you?
I am doing well also. I just consumed a bunch of caffeine, so that should help me be smart. I usually do that. I drink one of those Monster energy drinks. You ever drink those?
I do not. I stay away from those things.
That's a smart move. I get the ones without sugar, so at least there's not that, but I'm sure there's all these dyes and other stuff that I shouldn't be consuming, but it's a good caffeine push for me, and it's gonna help out, trust me. All right. Josh and his wife, Lori, started in a tough financial situation, starting from about $240,000 in debt to early retirement. This includes divorces, a foreclosure, a Chapter 7 bankruptcy, basically living paycheck to paycheck for about 3 years or more. And the cool part is Josh retired back in April of 2025 at age 48. Today, we'll talk about Josh's journey to retiring early, and we'll actually have a part two where we will cover how he's spending his time and any challenges or, you know, successes that he's having with this early retirement. One really cool thing is Josh and Lori are willing to share their numbers and net worth in a lot of details that are normally held close to the chest. So I'm excited to get into it. We're going to cover a lot of ground, but today we will focus on the journey. So first off, I just want to jump to the end. How's life right now? So you haven't been working for a few months. What have you been up to? Has it been overwhelming? What's it like?
It's been great. Definitely not overwhelming, although there are moments, which we can certainly save for part two, where I feel a little bit uncertain of what I should be doing and whether or not I'm doing the things that I thought I was going to be doing in retirement. So there's that whole side of it where I'm having conversations with my wife constantly, and we're looking at my to-do list or going back to reference things that I said I was going to do. And just trying to evaluate. I can't get away from evaluations for whatever reason. So I'm still sort of evaluating and making sure that, am I living the life that I want to live with all this newfound freedom?
Interesting. Yeah. And that totally makes sense. I mean, probably that's like a ongoing conversation that we should all be having, like, hey, are we spending our time on the right thing? Like, what's important and all that. So very cool. Now, has it been like a decompression time frame? Have you felt a weight lifted? What's that like?
I think quite honestly, I was a little bit like you, Doug, in that I probably wasn't the most or the best employee over my career. I did a good job and I did well enough to gain promotions along the way, but I wasn't fully invested in my career. It never felt like it was who I was or who I am. So I made the decision that I was going to leave full-time work 2 years prior to leaving. And I actually ended up telling my boss about 14 months before I left. I gave him plenty of notice. And we went through an entire transition phase where we hired my replacement while I was still there. And the last couple of months or so, I was really just taking the foot off the gas pretty significantly and coasting quite a bit.
Nice.
So I didn't really feel like I had to decompress too much.
That's great. It's actually, I think that's a great way to do it, because you could very gradually like relax versus, you know, if there's a sudden change, like you could feel it, but if you're very gradually going into it, and I love that you were able to like, hopefully work on the transition with your replacement and all that, and then like delegate everything. So you hardly had anything to do. Is that what happened?
That's exactly what happened. Yeah, it was great.
That's awesome. So let's start at the beginning. I mentioned you guys were deeply in debt. You had some financial struggles. Talk about that a little bit. Like, where were you coming from? Can you talk about sort of the origin story before you discovered FI and what life was like back then?
Sure. My wife, Lori, and I, we both came from similar backgrounds. As you mentioned, we were both previously divorced. We married and had kids when we were very young, in our early 20s, both of us. So I have three boys. She has one girl. We're a blended family. We got together in around 2007, 2008, and got married in 2010. And we both came from positions where finances was not something, and money, personal financial situations were not strong in that category. So we both had a lot of debt. I went through my divorce and we had a lot of medical debt and a lot of consumer debt. And through that process, my attorney that I had going through the divorce said, you might want to look at bankruptcy. So I started looking into that process. And then at that point, that's when you really start to pull all the information together and understand how much debt you do have. And that was very eye-opening for me because I hadn't even tracked it, didn't even pay attention. And when we worked through that process, Lori and I did together. And she came from a very similar situation too, where she was recently divorced and finances she was in a very tough spot. And in fact, there was at one point, the house that she had, she was a couple of months behind in her mortgage payment. So times were pretty tough and we were having conversations about pulling our money together, our finances together so that we can have a combined effort to try to attack it, the situation together. And I just remember sitting with her one day and she was essentially in tears, just wishing that she said she wished she could pay her bills on time. Mm-hmm. And she was actually trying to decide, should I pay for water this month or should we pay for electric? And which one should we float? Which one should we write a check to and know that it's going to be a week or so before it gets cashed and hopefully we'll get paid by then. So really lean times, very, very tough times in the early part of our relationship.
What kind of work did you do? And Lori's still working currently, right?
She is. Yeah.
Okay. Which we'll get into that. But one thing I didn't mention, relatively modest salaries overall. So can you tell us about that a little bit?
Sure. Yeah. We both did earn bachelor's degrees. So we did have some slightly higher paying jobs. We weren't really starting at an entry level situation. We were 30 years old whenever we got together and we were both 30. And our salaries at the time were relatively low. Now, this was 18 years ago, but I think I was making somewhere around 45 to 50, and she was making somewhere around 25 to 30.
And I guess we could jump to some of the more exciting numbers too, since I mentioned it earlier. So what is your current net worth? And we'll talk about some, you know, signposts along the way as well. But currently, what does it sit at? Can you talk a little bit about the real estate holdings, tax advantaged accounts, brokerage accounts, and that kind of thing? And you don't have to be exact. You could round to the tens of thousands or whatever is relevant, just so people have a rough idea of what's going on.
Sure. So our current net worth is approximately $2.7 million. We started purchasing single family home real estate back in 2016, and including our home, which we do not have a mortgage on any longer, our total real estate value is about $1.2 million. So it's a little less than half of our net worth. And then as far as our other accounts, we have about $1.3 million in our tax deferred accounts, and then somewhere about around $150,000 or so across our taxable accounts, and then the rest is in cash.
Okay. Thanks for sharing that. That is a big request from listeners out there. They love to hear numbers, and there's other shows and certain guests do want to share that kind of stuff. Others are a little more private. I'm curious, Josh, because I talked to you, we had a pre-interview discussion and I was like, do you want to share numbers? Like, is that cool? Double check with Lori. Why are you both comfortable sharing stats like this?
I think it's mainly comes from the perspective of just trying to be helpful and to offer some perspective in that we came from a very difficult situation where we were below zero as far as net worth. And we really turned things around in a very short period of time. And we didn't go through, or we can go through the timeline, but it was really just over the last like 12 to 15 years where we really turned the corner and grew that in that period of time. And so hopefully it can be inspirational to people that are in a difficult situation, or maybe they're still in that middle phase of the messy middle where it feels like things aren't really accelerating at the pace that they thought that things would. And it just takes a little bit of time, but it doesn't take as much time as even really I thought that it would have looking back now.
Yeah, it's crazy. And it's amazing. I'll summarize some stuff in a second here. But yeah, like you shared the information. And of course, looking back, we're thinking, because we're roughly the same age. So thinking back, it's like, yeah, that was a long time ago. I had a full head of hair, man, right? Like it was so different back then. Full-time job, like I was trying to do certain things. And it seems like it was just a few days ago, but it was like 15 years ago. Yeah. And looking forward, like 15 years seems like forever, but like time's going by, like every second, every day, it's just going. So you may as well, I mean, eventually compound interest kicks in, but the thing that I observed, and you mentioned, so you got married in 2010, is that right?
Yep.
So 15 years ago, roughly 240K in the hole. You figured that portion out. Within 6 years, you started buying real estate. Good time frame. The markets have been favorable. You really turned things around. And then, yeah, like people say, you know, you get the first 100K or whatever, 200 or some amount. And then the compound interest really kicks in. And you were able to retire within 15 years, which is not bad. And you started this at like roughly age 33. So I know some people are like, oh, I feel so behind and blah, blah, blah. I didn't discover any of this stuff until I was like 35. So it's like, yeah, people, you have plenty of time. And even if you're in your 30s or 40s, it's like you can accelerate it. And I mean, if you start a little later, like your end of plan is like your death. It's going to be, that's what they call it. They say end of plan, the end of plan, like you have less years to live and to cover those expenses. So it is inspirational. And I think it's cool that you're sharing the numbers here. So, okay. When did you start getting out of debt? How did this take place?
Yeah, there was some of those early conversations that Lori and I were having where it was just, we were in such poor financial shape that I think we both came to the relationship with a commitment that we were going to do better with our finances and just with life in general. We were going to make better choices and be more intentional. That was something that I didn't appreciate in my 20s. It was just like, yeah, you know, just do whatever you want, whenever you want, spend money, I'll make more, no problem. But we started having some of those conversations and looking at our finances. And at some point along the line, we stumbled across a television show called Till Death Do Us Part. And it's very obscure. It was a Canadian television show that was broadcast in the US on maybe like TLC or, you know, one of those cable networks. And in it, she was looking at people's debt, usually a couple, and she was looking at their debt and then projecting out over a period of time. Like in 5 years, you're going to be at this point in debt. And it was very eye-opening if they didn't make any changes. So she would work with them and go through their expenses. And that was like the first time that we had ever even heard of the need to look back at your expenses and figure out where your money went. And then from there, she would take them through her budgeting plan. And they worked on an all cash budget where they were putting money into jars. And I think like Dave Ramsey has an envelope system that's very similar to this, but we actually used that for quite a while where we would take out a certain amount of cash and set it aside for gas and groceries and other categories. And if we ran out of that cash, we didn't spend more. We set our debit cards at the time to the side. And that's how we learned how to manage our money and how to not overspend in those categories.
was it a tough like behavioral adjustment, or because you were more mature in your 30s and you guys were trying to make more intentional decisions, was it easier to not go out to eat as much, or like you walk by the display at department store or Best Buy or whatever, and you're like, oh, I want to buy that thing over there. So was it hard to like not buy stuff?
I think it was hard, but we understood the reason why we were doing it. And I was all in from the beginning. Lori was a little bit apprehensive, but she knew that in order for us to turn the corner and head in a better direction and get to that point where we were able to pay our bills on time, like that was our first goal. Let's get our bills paid on time. Let's make sure we don't run in a risk of getting our utilities shut off or a foreclosure letter coming for her house. And so it was tough to kind of change some of our spending philosophy, but easy from the aspect that we knew that this made sense and that it was going to help us in the long run.
When did you have like a net worth of zero and actually turn the corner?
I didn't even really learn about the concept of net worth until a few years past kind of just learning how to budget and spend money or manage money. I think it was around 2012 or so that I stumbled across, I think it was Budgets Are Sexy, the blog by Jay Money. Mm-hmm. And shortly after that, I found Carl, Mr. 1500, and they were publishing their net worth, both of them. And so I was like, oh, what is this? And it was so obvious to me that I came from an industry that we were all about the numbers. We were all about measuring our performance and metrics and all of those things, but it never dawned on me that we should be doing something like that in our personal life. So to answer your question, I think it was around the end of 2012 that I started tracking the net worth and found that we were at positive 25,000. But in the two or three years prior to that was definitely below zero.
Okay. Got it. Very cool. And what, who cares what job you did, but just for the story, what industry and what kind of work did you do?
Yeah, I worked for a really good company, actually. It was founded and based in St. Louis when I started with the company, and it was called Sigma Aldrich. It was a life sciences company, so like chemical manufacturing, but we did a lot of really cool like diagnostic kits and things like that for the healthcare industry. And so I was in supply chain for most of my career, where I was in production planning, which kind of is funny in a sense that I was a planner. I did a lot of planning for work, but I didn't do any planning in my personal life. And I think that it, as you were talking about earlier with your situation and on the HOA and the sound check, you have that ability that you took from your corporate job that you can now use in your personal life. And it took me a while to kind of discover that I, all the things that I did in my corporate job, I could apply that to my personal life. And it was a lot more intentional, a lot more successful in the things that I was in our financial situation, the things that we were able to do. So I think that it was a good job, good company, but definitely never was something that I was truly passionate about.
And what was your degree in?
Business.
Okay. So just general, and then you ended up in supply chain. You could work a spreadsheet, that kind of thing.
Yep, exactly.
So did you have your identity like tied up in your profession at all? Like, what was your title?
At the end, it was head of production planning. So I had a few sites in the St. Louis area that I was responsible for. But no, I would not say that it was my identity at all. I typically was not, that was not what I chose to tell people when they asked what I did or where I work or whatever. I didn't really get into too much detail and definitely didn't kind of tie myself to that.
What do you tell people you do now?
Actually, it hasn't came up in the 4 months or so that it's been. It really hasn't came up. I mean, most people are aware of my situation. And I think that I'm actually surprised that there's fewer questions than I anticipated. If I had to meet somebody new, I would like to have the courage to say that I'm retired, but I'm not sure that I'm fully comfortable with that yet. I even as I was landing the plane, so to speak, and transitioning away from full-time work, I struggled with being able to tell people at work that I was retiring. People would always just say that. I would say, I'm leaving full-time work. I'm going to concentrate on my rental properties and do all these other things, part-time work, whatever. So it was really tough for me to come to terms with using that word.
But eventually you did.
I did. Yeah. I'm definitely using it more now. Okay. I'm getting more comfortable with it.
What did your peers at work think, or maybe people that worked with you or for you? Did anyone take an interest like, oh, really? Like you seem pretty young. Like, can you tell me about it? Anyone give a shit?
There is a couple of people that are, there's one person that was another member of our local Choose If I chapter. So we've had conversations over the years about things. And then there was another guy who he's very interested, and we still talk about it outside of, and since I've left work, and we've met up a couple times, and he's wanting to join the local group. So I think there was a little bit of inspiration there across a couple of people. Most people were like, oh, that's nice. Yeah. That must be nice.
Yeah. Yeah. You. They're like, whatever. Interesting. Well, and the thing is, like, if one person like kind of pays attention, they maybe could retire like whatever, 15 years earlier or something. Like, it completely changes their life and trajectory and stuff like that. Like, it doesn't have to be that many people if just one person, because I hear that every now and then, folks that I interview, they're like, oh yeah, I talked to this person my second day at work, and they were like, be sure you do this and you'll be in great shape in a few years. And they're like, yep, like it worked out and I retired at 33 or whatever. So, So back to the story, 2012, net worth about 25K, you turn the corner, you mentioned 1.2 million in real estate, you have some properties, you started buying them in 2016. Talk about that and landlording and the amount of work that you do and all that kind of stuff. So huge question. We'll pause along the way, but talk about the early years when you were like, you know what? I think real estate is a great way to leverage what we have.
Sure. That was something that I was always interested in, even going back to my 20s for whatever reason. I think I got the bug whenever I had my first home, my starter home, in my early 20s and sold it. I did a lot of the work to it to rehab it because it was a kind of a fixer upper. And when I sold it to buy my next house, I had a pretty decent profit, and it was all sweat equity at the time. And so then that got me interested in doing that as like side work. And I knew that I wanted to purchase properties. I just didn't really know how to acquire the capital. And again, I was terrible with finances, so I didn't have any savings. But around 2010, 2011, I started doing some side work as a handyman for a lady who owned approximately 50 properties or something like that in the St. Louis area. And it was little odd jobs. I would do them after work, like changing furnace filters or maybe just checking on a call or a complaint that a tenant had, just little things like that. And I worked for her for a few years and just kind of tried to have conversations with her to gain some of that knowledge and understand how she managed things, because they were all self-managed. She didn't have a management company. She just had a couple of people that worked for her doing a variety of the jobs. And so I learned a lot from her and still didn't know how I was going to purchase my first property. But I ended up, and it was like 2016. The market was a little different back then. But the first property that we purchased, I actually took a loan from my 401k. And I withdrew $40,000. I don't remember what my balance on my 401k was at the time, but it was pretty significant. And we found a property that was $30,000. And in the St. Louis market, that's still not unheard of. You can still find fixer-uppers that are going to be well south of $100,000 to this day, 10 years later. This one was outside of St. Louis, though, in a smaller town. And I withdrew $40,000 from my 401k. The house cost 30. It was in good structural condition, but it needed a lot of cosmetic upgrades and improvement. Just nasty carpet, ugly paint, some damage here and there on the interior. So we bought that house and put $10,000 of work into it over the course of a month. My wife, Lori, and I, we worked on it night and day. We took a week of vacation and then we would go there after work and we fixed it up and we got it rented 30 days later. And we refinanced it after 6 months. There was a seasoning period. So this is the whole BRRRR strategy: buy, rehab, rent, refinance, repeat. And we refinanced it about 6 months later. It was worth, I think, $85,000. And we were able to take 80% of that out. And then we paid off that 401k loan and still had $30,000, I think, give or take, left over that we were then able to put into our next property.
Got it. Okay. Super interesting that a house costs the price of a car. So we talked a little bit about this in the pre-interview. So I've interviewed a lot of folks and, like, you know, times change and the markets change and interest rates change. How, like, likely do you think it's possible for someone to do like what you did? Like, could you do that same thing now, like knowing what you know and assuming this similar constraints? Like, could you find a place? Of course, there's some inflation. It would cost a little bit more, but probably, you know, say 50K for a house instead. So is it possible to do what you did now?
I think so. It's definitely market dependent and it takes guts and courage. I remember one part I left out was whenever we closed on the property, and I turned over that $30,000 that I had just worked so hard to accumulate over the, you know, coming from below zero net worth to then taking that loan against my 401k. I thought I was going to throw up in the parking lot of the title company where we closed. I mean, it was the most, I don't know, one of the most emotional moments financially that I experienced. But to answer your question, I think it's definitely doable still. And in fact, we purchased a couple more properties in recent years. One that we purchased from an investor who had just let the property go and it had been vacant and damaged. And we bought it for $20,000. We fixed it up. We put about $100,000 into it and it appraised for $215,000 when we were finished with it. And that's in the St. Louis area. So St. Louis is definitely low cost of living area in the Midwest. But I think there's still pockets and cities across the country that are going to be similar.
Good answer. You worked with the real estate investor as a handyman for a few years, couple years or whatever. Mm-hmm. So you kind of saw like what it would take and you understood the business and probably, I assume, you realized, hey, I can do this. Like, I have some of the skills. I'm doing a lot of the work. You're learning along the way. I don't have the same traits. I don't like that kind of work. I don't like the people in the real estate industry, just generally. Painting with a broad brush. So I'm not talking about any listeners specifically. It's just, I don't like real estate that much. Not my thing. It's great for other folks. Do you have any suggestions for people to help them understand? Maybe they haven't done that kind of work before, but they hear about the leverage and the impact to your net worth that real estate can bring to the table. Like, I mean, it's great if your personality fits it. So what traits do you think are good for a new real estate investor to have?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think for me, what was beneficial is that I enjoy the hands-on process. So I don't have any problem getting in there and trying to learn how to fix something or to get my hands dirty or to sweat or, you know, all of those things. I don't have any problem with the DIY stuff. That's what benefited us the most, my wife and I. And I think over time, you get more comfortable with the things that will go wrong, and things will. I mean, you hear the inevitable toilet that's overflowing in the middle of the night. We haven't, knock on wood, we have not actually had that experience, but we've had plenty of emergencies, almost emergencies. You know, they're on the verge of becoming something that's a disaster. We've had plenty of those, and you just kind of get used to it over time. So you just have to have a lot of, I guess, mental fortitude to be able to understand that you're just trying to solve a problem in most cases. And then the more you have, I mean, we only have eight, this isn't a huge portfolio by any means, but the more that you have, the more opportunity you have to be able to scale. If you run into an HVAC problem, it's just going to typically be on one property. You're not going to have multiple going down all at once. So as long as you kind of understand that you're going to have some issues with maintenance and repairs along the way, that you just have to budget for that and kind of pull that out of your expenses and make sure that you have savings. Those are kind of the things that are most important, in my opinion.
Do you have any fun disaster stories? Or I'll give you a side one if you don't have one handy. A project that you thought wasn't going to be too bad, and then you pulled up the carpet and who knows what was underneath there, like the scope of work changed dramatically. Either one of those.
Yeah, on the second point there, the house that we bought for $20,000 from the investor who had let it go and it was vacant, we thought that we were going to be able to get in there and do a cosmetic upgrade and improvement to it. We actually walked through the property and we checked everything. We did our due diligence. We did not have an inspection, which is, there was a lot of times I didn't have an inspection, but I thought that I was qualified enough that I could do my own inspection. And so that was my first mistake. We went through, we went to a brewery afterwards, Lori and I, and we wrote down everything that we saw and we put together an estimate for what we thought the expenses were going to be. We thought we'll put another 20 or 30,000 into this. So it's going to be a $50,000 all in investment. And at the end, this house is going to be worth 120 or something like that. So we're going to be in great shape. We can rent it. It's a decent area. It's going to be fine. And we got in there, started cleaning up. We had a couple things that we were, like a small wall we were going to remove and a few other things. And as we started getting into the walls, we started realizing that behind the walls, there was like squirrels' nests everywhere. And the house was poorly insulated. It had been rehabbed probably 20 or 30 years ago. It was a 130-year-old house. And it just kind of snowballed. It turned into what we thought was going to be a couple of month project. Ended up taking us 3 years.
3 years. Holy cow.
And it was a labor of love. The mantra that we used during that entire project was, it's going to be beautiful. That's what we kept saying to each other. And so we got to a point where we're just like, we're all in. Let's just do it all. We ripped out all the drywall, all the way down the studs, found that the wiring had been disconnected in several places. The plumbing had been cut and ripped out, which we knew some of that going in, but we completely rehabbed the entire house. We made some modifications to the floor plan, all new electric, plumbing, HVAC, the whole nine yards. And it was essentially a brand new house with a brick shell after a 130-year-old brick shell whenever we were finished with it.
Oh, man. That's crazy. Was it pretty quick when you were like, oh, this is going to be much worse? Or was it over the course of like a few weeks as you were like, okay, we'll do a little bit more. And then it was like a little bit more and just scope creep that way? Or was it all of a sudden like, this is a total disaster?
I think it was just over the course of maybe the first few weeks that we, as we started to dig in, we're like, oh shit, this is worse than what we expected it to be. And we just went with it though. It was after the initial shock, I think we were excited that we had finally the experience. It was kind of a bucket list item of mine to be able to take a house all the way down to the studs and just start from scratch. So we were able to do it. I don't think that we would do it again. it's kind of those one of those one and done type of things that we're, I'm glad that we had the experience. Now I know it's not in the back of my mind, you know, itching at me and wondering what that would be like. I've crossed that one off the list.
You made a comment earlier on the first house when you bought it for $30K, which you borrowed from your 401k, and you were like, you mentioned you were a little emotional. It sounded like you were just like, I hope this works. And then a few months later, like, you turned a profit, you were able to pay it off, you had seed money for your next property. Can you talk about the emotion on the other side? Like, have you felt like the corresponding, you were like, we figured it out, like, we did it? Was it early on? Has it been ongoing? Like, did you have an epiphany like that?
I think the entire journey has taken, it's had its share of ups and downs, but over recent months, we were projecting to have a certain number for cash flow per month. And we've still continued to struggle to realize that full potential of what we thought, which I'll just mention, it was $2,000. We thought we were going to be able to be in a spot where we were going to have consistent ongoing cash flow of $2,000 a month. And after setting aside everything for capital expenses, repairs and maintenance, and all of that, and we reached that point earlier this year, and it hasn't been as consistent as we thought it would be. So it's definitely had its shares of ups and downs. And it's just one of those things that even now, I'm almost 10 years into this, but there's moments of doubt still where I'm like, is this what I want to do 10 years from now or 15 years from now? Do I get to a point where I maybe sell off one or two of these to cover some of the mortgages on the others? Do I maybe make this a plan for the next 8 years where I sell one a year, like I just accumulated one a year? Or do I trade up to nicer properties? You know, so those kind of the questions are always in our mind.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, it kind of answers the question. And that is one of the questions that I have. Like, have you, because you have a good portfolio, it doesn't sound like you have goals to make it super huge. Like, have you played out some of these scenarios where you're like, what if I sell three of them right now? And then conceivably, that's a little bit less work. It's less cash flow, but you also have that money right now, which you can do whatever, like pay off the mortgages. So your cash flow potentially could improve from that, or you can invest it, which could grow if you do index funds or whatever. So what does that look like? How do you figure that out?
That's a great question. It's a question that we're asking ourselves all the time. We just had a conversation a couple of weeks ago where we were trying to think through the best way strategically to maybe cut one or two of these properties. And one of the things that we're not super savvy in is tax optimization. So that's something that we would need some help with if we were to, you know, what are the rules? Is there, what are the capital gains that are associated with that? What would that look like? And that's just some research that I need to do. But there, yeah, we've thought about all that. If we sell a couple, maybe we pay off a mortgage, maybe our cash flow dips a little bit, but maybe it's more consistent because we get rid of the problem property and we invest some, like you said, into our taxable account. That's going to give us some more flexibility from that perspective. So I guess it's a good problem to have, but it's definitely one of those, I didn't anticipate that I would be at this point with the real estate that I am right now, where it's a little bit due to some other situations that are ongoing with the properties. It's like a little bit frustrating. And we expected a more consistent cash flow situation that we haven't fully realized yet.
Why is it inconsistent? Just there's not tenants in there as much as you expected, or?
Yeah, we have a trouble tenant that she's going to be leaving at the end of the month. Not an eviction situation, but just not caught up in rent. So that, I mean, typically, and that's something that should have been accounted for from a vacancy standpoint, but I didn't account for it. You know, in hindsight, you're always learning in this business too. And in hindsight, a vacancy can also mean that a person is there, but they're not paying the rent. And I looked at it from the perspective of, we don't have anybody in there. And I have a lot higher level of confidence that I can get somebody in pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. So I didn't anticipate my vacancy would be as long as what it currently is. So now we're going on a couple of months without a payment, without rent coming in. So that's kind of put a strain on our overall budget.
Gotcha. That makes sense. And it's like someone's just not paying, or they're all like a couple months behind or whatever. It's like they're doing just enough so that they can't be evicted, that kind of thing.
Yeah, basically. Yep.
All right. So I want to move on a little bit away from real estate, but anything else you want to add about the real estate angle or how it played in your journey?
I think, you know, just to summarize, it's been a great wealth building tool. And a lot of the properties that we purchased were well below market value. And we had to put in a lot of work to improve those and bring them up. So I use those numbers. I just try to be very conservative from an estimate standpoint on what I think their value is. But it can be certainly a rewarding way to invest.
Could you have done, maybe it doesn't matter, right? Because you didn't do this, but I'm curious, if you didn't buy real estate, have you run the numbers to see how the same investment capital at the beginning would have done in the market?
I haven't done that. I don't even really know exactly where to begin with that, but I think for a lot of our properties, we purchased them far enough below that they had a lot of appreciation. Now, the market overall in the St. Louis area isn't going to appreciate like some other areas are going to, and it hasn't over the last 10 years. It's relatively flat, probably 2% or something like that. But there was a significant enough gap between what we purchased it for and what the value became, because we put so much work into it, or so much of our time into it, that it was forced appreciation. So I don't know if we would have gotten the same results out of the market, but it would be an interesting exercise. And then what's the trade-off there? Is it all the time and energy and stress and aggravation that we've dealt with over these 10 years? Would we have experienced that if we were just putting that money into the market? Right. Probably not.
And that's, it's just a interesting thought exercise. And I remember chatting with Carl a couple years ago. Elizabeth and I had a relatively small house in Bozeman, and we made some money on it. I think we bought it for like $212 or something like that. Sold it for like $280 or so. And we were like, this is awesome. We did a good job. I thought about, hey, we could rent it. Bozeman's a good area. The property, I think, like more than doubled in value. And I was like, we could rent it out. It's a college town, and a lot of people did move to Bozeman. But Carl mentioned, like, well, what'd you do with the money instead? I was like, I invested in index funds. He was like, I bet it's not really that far off, especially when you consider the time and the hassle and like the potentially property management that I would have to pay for. So he was like, the delta probably isn't that far off, in because those were good years in the stock market. So that I never went back to actually calculate it, but mentally I'm like, you know what? It wasn't like the worst decision, even though the money or the house value probably doubled, and I could have potentially like made some money on the rent at the same time. Like, pretty sure my other investments doubled and everything was fine, and I'm happy where things are at, and I didn't have to like try to manage a house from, you know, two states away. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. So back on track here. You're buying some homes. You're in sort of the middle. You have four kids in the household, and I don't have kids, but I hear they can be expensive. What was going on in life at this point? So we're talking 2017 to 2019, roughly.
Okay. Yeah, they were all probably in their teenage years. They definitely were. And they were getting more expensive around that time. So braces, school, starting to think about college. And one of the things that we chose to do because we were in such poor shape financially is we kind of looked out for ourselves first, and we made sure that we were investing in our future, myself, my wife and I, Lori. And we didn't go crazy trying to fund college education for our kids. We weren't even sure how many of them would be interested in that path. And my mindset was kind of changing a little bit around that same time too, and that I wasn't sure that college was the right direction for a young person in today's day and age. And our daughter, she did decide to go to college. And in Missouri, there is a program called the A+ Scholarship, which is basically, as long as you meet a certain couple of criteria when you're in high school, you get the first 2 years of like junior college paid for. And so three of our four kids took advantage of that program, which was great. And they had a little bit of time in college, two of the boys, and decided they didn't want to continue to pursue college through a bachelor's degree. Our daughter did. She went through a bachelor's degree, got a master's degree, but she kept it all local. So we really encouraged that we would help support in whatever way we could, whether that was with books or maybe some fees. We tried to encourage minimal student loan debt so that they wouldn't be burdened with that later. And I think that was probably the height of kid expenses, was in that time frame. So we had braces, we had college coming up, we had sports and activities and all of those things. But then shortly after that, in the early 2020s, they all started moving out. So
gotcha. Are they all out of the house now?
We have one still at home.
Okay. How old?
He's 19.
19. Okay. So adult. Will he be moving out soon, or are you kicking him out, or what? How do you handle that?
That's a good question. I know he wants to, but he's probably not ready yet. So we'll see how that plays out.
When did you move out? Like you went to college, you got your bachelor's. Like when were you out of the house?
I went to college kind of like locally part time, and I think I didn't move out until I was 21.
Okay. Gotcha. Yeah. And I went locally in Atlanta, but I lived on campus, and I was on like the 6.5 year plan. I did a co-op program. So it was like I worked and took classes. So I paid for it that way. And then I didn't have a job like right out of school. So I lived with my parents for like, I think it was like a month or so until I got a job. And then I was traveling roughly full time and like kind of crashed around. I stayed with my sister like on weekends when I was home, and then moved in with some coworkers because we were all traveling. So it was like, you're just kind of there for the weekend and that sort of thing. But yeah, it's interesting because like it's expensive to like, I mean, it depends on where you live and all that stuff, but and you got to be ready. But I was, you know, I was ready to work and travel and do all that stuff. But it is interesting. Is there some, you don't have to answer this. Is there some age where you're like, buddy, you know, you do need to, you're 30 years old now, my man.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely don't want to get to that age. I would say early 20s should be ideal, and he's working full time, so he'll get there. But you know, I think going back to college just for a second it can be controversial.
Yeah, totally. And
I'm not an advocate for that path or plan, especially when a kid doesn't necessarily know what they want to do, or maybe their preferred or selected direction with their degree isn't going to necessarily make them a lot of money. So I came from a background where my parents didn't really have the means to help me with college. And it was all pretty much self-funded with a little bit of loans here and there. And then whenever I started my career, I didn't mention earlier, but I worked for the same company for 25 years, and they had a tuition reimbursement program. So that's how I finished my bachelor's degree, and they paid for all of it. And those plans still exist. So I always told my kids, like, why go into debt and why come out of school with tens of thousands of dollars in debt when you could go be earning money and take advantage of a tuition reimbursement program, go to school part-time in the evenings or whatever the schedule would look like, and just kind of hack your way through it instead of taking out the massive amounts of debt.
Right. Yeah, it is controversial. And I mean, I don't have kids, so it's easy for me to, I have a lot of opinions on it. I want to tell everybody what to do, but no, I'm just kidding. It's a tough one. And I think, you know, part of it is the ROI on a specific degree. And if it's like, you want to be an engineer, a doctor, like certain thing, accounting, like there's certain professions where it's like, that's the path. And although I wouldn't necessarily encourage someone to be like, hey, go into engineering or whatever, but not that it's bad, but if you want to, you can, but talk to engineers and figure out what it's like. On the other side, obviously there's like some fun social experiences that you could do. And it's not that you could only get them at colleges, but there's some atmosphere. There's an environment at a college, especially like a not a commuter school. And commuter schools are fine also, but like everything has a cost and a trade-off and all that. And now I'm like, yeah. I mean, trades are, I mean, become a, like learn construction and handyman skills or whatever, HVAC, plumbing, like fill in the blank. Like it's hard to get contractors out there. And I think if you like doing this stuff or you have a light interest, like you could definitely check it out. And it may be a very like profitable way to just kind of short circuit the system, or travel or go to national parks and stuff. Like there's a bunch of stuff I would say, work in national parks, hang out, go to, you know, travel with the seasons and all that kind of stuff. But anyway, any other thoughts on college and all that kind of stuff, or if people have kids?
I was going to mention on your point there with the just travel and see, follow the seasons. My oldest son is actually doing that now. He and his girlfriend, they converted a van, an older van, into a camper van.
Nice.
And they're currently in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And they're working. He worked for a couple of years, saved up some money, and now they're just off on this adventure. And they are working at a campground and just doing like whatever needs to be done. They get free RV or camp rental space. Sure. And they work for the ground. So, I mean, there's so many different, like you said, so many different routes that you can take. But I mean, it's super cool that he's doing that now. And it's like 60 degrees there, where it's like 97 degrees here at St. Louis.
Yeah. That's super cool. And the other thing, like somewhat related, like they're understanding like how cheap they can live also. Mm-hmm. And they're like, we're super happy in a van. They're like the camp host or whatever, and like get to meet new people. It's social. They're hanging out, probably living super cheap. And there's a story that Derek Sivers tells. Do you know Derek Sivers? Do you know that guy?
I know the name.
He has a blog. He's like featured in the 4-Hour Work Week. But he got a question that essentially was, tell the story of when you got rich. And people expect the story of when he sold his company CD Baby for like, I think 20 some million or something, a lot of money. But it was when he saved up $12,000 and quit his job, because he felt rich then. He knew if he had 12,000 bucks, he could live for like a year, because he could pick up some odd jobs and be a musician. He was a guitar player and singer, I believe. So he was like, I felt rich when I had $12,000, because I knew I could do whatever I want. I had freedom and I could quit my job, which is an interesting way to put it. And then, yeah, like your son, it's like, oh, we could live on almost nothing, be super happy, spend time outdoors, meet people and all that stuff. It's pretty cool. Definitely a route.
Yeah, definitely. And that's the mindset, or I guess intentionality, that I lacked whenever I was in my 20s. Instead, I was having kids and, you know, very tied down and didn't have those same experiences. And now, part of the reason why I wanted to be on the early retirement path was so that I can make up for lost time. So now, and we'll definitely get into that later. But once you reach a point where you have a lot more freedom, then you can choose, and a little bit of money, then you can choose to take on some of these adventures that maybe you didn't have whenever you were younger, like me.
We could talk all day for sure, but we'll put a pin in it. We'll come back to some of this stuff for episode two, but let's hit a couple checkpoints here. So end of 2019, net worth of about 675K. By the end of 2022, you had 1.7 million. So what was that like? Because you're like, okay, we're making progress. You obviously have some real estate. Things are growing. You're adding to the pile. And then at some point, you became millionaires, and then things are going awesome. So talk about that a little bit. Like, was this on a specific timeline? How were you guys feeling? And were you like, I'm going to quit pretty soon?
Yeah, I think for me personally, when I started to get to that stage, and it was gradual over a period of time, but I went from those early stages of just so much stress and anxiety around money and not knowing whether or not I was going to be able to cover my expenses, to getting to the point where there was no concern whatsoever with finances. And that, it was very freeing. I think we've definitely had a lot of stress lifted off of us. We still had things going on in life, like kids and the real estate and all the things that were still somewhat of a distraction, but the finances was in line. And we went from a stage, from a period of time where we were checking in regularly and making sure that we were having our money dates and budgeting and all that sort of thing, to then we could gradually move to, maybe it was more of like an experience stage in our lives. So we had not done a lot of traveling together as a couple, and we started to take advantage of that more. The kids were older. We were able to do more. We were able to spend more money on those kinds of things. So I think that was kind of the turning point of where we were like, okay, we're feeling really good about our finances. And we were starting to have those conversations, like, when will I leave full-time work? Lori was, over a period of time, we were thinking about doing this together, and we can get into that a little bit more if you'd like, but she chose to continue to work, which is fine. And I'm Wi-Fi, and that's great. But I think that was right around that time that we decided that she was all in. We just had to check a few more boxes in order for her to be fully comfortable with me leaving full-time work. And yeah, that was a pretty good time in our lives where we were experimenting with travel and you know, doing lots of fun things.
Yeah. So Lori's still working. What's the story with that?
She loves her job. She is a social worker by trade, by education. And she works for a nonprofit where she oversees a staff that is in school-based therapy. So they place their therapists into schools and work with kids. And she enjoys everything she does. She works 4 days a week. We have conversations all the time about, is she ready to leave? Does she want to cut back? Is she still getting everything out of it she wants to? Is she happy with my direction and the balance that we have between one of us is not working and the other one is? And so far she wants to continue. She doesn't have necessarily an end in sight, but she's one of those weirdos, Doug, that likes their job.
Yeah. Well, you know what? That one's a little bit different. It's like helping people. You could see the weirdest ones are where people have like a corporate job and they like that. I will call those people out. What are you guys doing?
Yeah.
One thing we haven't talked about is your expenses. So I don't know if it makes sense to go through some of the historical expenses or just what your expenses are right now. So I'll kind of leave it open, like whatever you think is most relevant and helpful to understand how much you guys are spending.
Yeah, I think the easiest would be just to talk about it right now. And we don't do a phenomenal job of tracking or anything like that, or reflecting back and seeing. We did that for years. We grew that muscle of understanding kind of where we needed to be and developed a certain lifestyle that we were pretty comfortable with. So at this point in time, we spend about $4,000 a month total. And occasionally we'll have a big expense that'll come in. So for the most part, Lori's net income will cover our full expenses, and we're not in a withdrawal situation. And we even still are investing. She still contributes to her 401k and HSA. But from our expenses, about half of that 4,000 or so is fixed expenses. So things like utilities and taxes and insurance and just the things that are common with everyday life. We don't have a mortgage. We don't have car payments. We don't have any consumer debt. We live in a very low cost of living area. And so we do the majority of whatever we want to do is like just what I call discretionary spending, which covers the other 2,000 or so a month. And we have a lot of fun. Sometimes we'll spend that full amount. Other times we won't necessarily spend it all, and we can roll it forward, and we're able to take trips and spend a little bit more on those experiences. So it's definitely lumpy, but that's kind of what our expenses look like today. It's about $4,000 a month.
Okay. Gotcha. That's pretty awesome. And like you said, you're in a low cost of living area, and that's for three of you. Cause like your son's like, how does that break down?
Yeah, he covers a lot of his own expenses. Okay. We will cover the things like the household items and groceries and things like that. But his expenses for car maintenance, repairs, those kinds of things, his insurance, his cell phone and stuff like that, he covers a lot of that himself.
Okay, cool. That's pretty good. No rent though. No, from him.
No. Okay. It's a good suggestion though. I like it.
Yeah. I don't know. Just a little bit, you know, he has some skin in the game. That's right. Having a house is not free. There's maintenance or whatever. There's always a leak or something like that. Okay. Very cool. So expenses pretty modest overall. If Lori were to leave work, I know you said there's no plans, but let's say in a few years she leaves work, how does that change the expenses, potentially healthcare? You do have some money in a taxable account, so you have some flexibility, but what does that look like if she were to leave work?
Yeah, it's something that we're not fully sure exactly what levers we would pull. We would have a lot of different options, I think, at our disposal. One of the things that I considered is looking into the 72T, because like you mentioned, we probably have about 2 to 3 years worth of runway in our cash savings. So we would, at some point, we would run out of that. And I don't know that we would have enough to do like the Roth conversion ladder. Mm-hmm. So we got to play around with that and try to just decide when is a good time to start maybe making some of those conversions over a period of time. But 72T might be an option for us. We both like to stay busy. So I think there's would be some opportunity for some kind of part-time work, whether it's just working for ourselves or taking odd jobs or whatever that might look like. We wouldn't necessarily need to do that, but just kind of knowing our personalities, I think we would stay busy with something like that. The rentals should give us some form of monthly cash and that should cover a portion of our expenses. So we have that as well. And then as far as healthcare, when I ran the numbers, it was showing that with the subsidies in the state of Missouri, it was going to be around $500 a month for the two of us. We didn't include our son at the time because he's able to get health insurance through his employer. So that could change, probably will change, and it might look different this year. I'm not sure. I haven't looked at it since then, but that's kind of what we were budgeting. And I think we could probably go quite a bit higher than that and not have too much of an impact on our finances.
Got it. Okay. Very good. Well, I think we covered a lot of the journey and we'll kind of start wrapping up, but basically, is there anything that I should have asked you that I didn't, that's important for the journey and the story and that sort of thing?
I think just kind of circling all the way back to the beginning with our financial situation, I mentioned that I went through a foreclosure and bankruptcy situation. Those were very, very tough times. And I hope that this conversation can be somewhat inspirational to someone who's maybe in a similar situation or knows somebody that's in a similar situation. We didn't make a lot of income. We just learned how to budget our money and start to save and then get intentional with our investments to get us to this point. And I think that even though some of the things like real estate might look a little different now, there's still a lot of opportunity for people out there that want to take action and be able to turn their financial situation around. So maybe that's just what I would add as a summary. And certainly I would definitely welcome the opportunity to talk to anybody about those types of, you know, more specific details if they were interested in learning more about it.
In the next episode, we'll talk a lot about how you're spending your time and things you want to do. I'm going to cheat a little bit because I know you're going to start a podcast and I want to hear a little bit about that. And that's a great way. I mean, I podcast, I like it. So it's a great way to spend time. But yeah, tell me a little bit about the show. What are you going to talk about? What's the name? And we'll link up and all that stuff so people can check it out. But yeah, what's the story with the pod?
Sure. So my buddy Elliot and I, we met at Economy back in 2024, just last year, a little over a year ago. And we're both from St. Louis, but we hadn't met in the local group. We hadn't crossed paths, but we met at Economy and we hit it off right away. We have a lot, even though we're 10 years apart in age, we have a lot of similar interests and things like that. He's well along on his path and trying to decide when he's going to pull the trigger. And we have really great conversations about what he's working through, what I'm working through, what's worked well for us, the challenges that we've had along the way. And we just somewhere along the line, one of us said, hey, we should probably start recording these conversations. So that's where the idea of the podcast came in. And we don't intend to get technical with any of this stuff. I mean, there's so many of those other resources that are available to people. We just want to be able to continue to tell our story and also help each other and potentially help other people. So one of the things that we're considering as a part of this journey is that maybe we will have the opportunity to work with people like in a one-on-one situation and just sort of give back. You know, this is all things that we've learned over the years and what has helped us. How can we find a way to help other people? So the show is going to be called 9to5. We'll play on words there.
Nice.
And we can be found at 9to5pod.com.
Cool. Sounds good. We'll link up to it. And I'm sure by the time this goes live, people will be able to check out a few episodes. And like I said, you're going to be on again and we'll be able to talk about how you're spending your time and hobbies and other fun stuff that is unrelated to finance directly. So thanks a lot, Josh. Really appreciate it. And looking forward to the next episode.
Thanks a lot, Doug. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to the show. That was the Mile High Five podcast, and I'm Doug Cunnington. If you dig the show, please do 3 things for us. Number 1, tell a friend, a family member, an enemy about the show. We really don't care who you tell. Maybe forward them a specific show that you know that they will like. It's the single most helpful thing that you can do to spread the word. It's like giving us a virtual high five, and actually we don't give high fives in person, so the virtual kind's pretty good. And more importantly, your friend or family member or even your enemy will appreciate the fact that you were thinking of them. Number 2, make sure you're following or subscribed on your podcast app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, YouTube, whatever you're using, and that way you won't miss a show. And number 3, please leave us a rating and review. We read them on the show occasionally, and you might hear yours out there on an upcoming episode. Quick disclaimer, this show is not financial or legal advice. I'd actually be surprised if it sounded like it. It's really just for entertainment, and that's at least what we're hoping for. But seriously, get advice from professionals. So we'll catch y'all next week. we were just talking. I was venting a little bit because I was in an HOA meeting for a few hours yesterday. And funny enough, I'm my own worst employee. And basically I was like, hey man, I'm going to send you an outline. And yesterday, like midday, maybe the end of the day, you were like, hey, did you say you were going to send an outline? And I was like, yep. And I haven't done it, but I'll probably be able to send you one later. And then as I was sitting in the HOA meeting, I sent you another email that said, now I'm going to finish it like 10 minutes before I talk to you. And then we'll just discuss it ahead of time. But you're in an HOA situation. What's the story? Are you on the board or what?
Yeah, I'm on the board. I joined ours and we have a fairly small subdivision. It's approximately 100 houses. And it has been ran by pretty much the same people since the onset of the formation of the subdivision. And I joined because I had a question one time. I just wanted to call in. They don't meet in person any longer. They're all virtual. They've been doing that for years. And there was only like three people there and they were like, hey, you want to join us? We're always looking for volunteers. I said, okay, I'll give this a shot. My question was revolving around some of my neighbors were clearly in violation of some of the rules. And I kind of got stuck. And some of those things have taken years to clean up with those violations. So that's kind of my experience with the HOA. Nothing happens fast.
Gotcha. And our situation here, I'm going to end up doing a whole episode with Rusty on ethics and philosophy, and it'll be a deep episode. And I've mentioned it in passing because I was like, things are still ongoing, so I kind of want to let them wind down. And ours are... it's nonsense. The neighborhood's about 5 years old. I think there's like 250 some odd houses, 27. I can't remember. There's a couple hundred houses. So it's not super huge. And it's a lot of like dysfunctional interaction and personalities that clash and that are on the board. And then before that, people that weren't on the board were like super upset and essentially yelling at the board. And for whatever reason, we have a management company. Is yours self-managed or is it?
Yes, okay. Self-managed.
So a little bit different and a lot more of the responsibility would probably fall on the board to do stuff. But we have a management company. And anyway, in my previous job, like I often facilitated meetings and work together with opposing parties, like different vendors or whomever. And anyway, this whole situation is crazy because it's like, apparently people that didn't have to work with opposing groups very often or whatever they said just kind of went through. And yeah, so it's totally bananas and awkward. And we had some meetings in person for a little while and those were super rough. And luckily, in a weird way, because I do a podcast and I haven't done a ton of speaking, but some people, as you know, communicate better than others. And maybe there's a little humor in something that I say. So like when I talk, like it's usually better received by most people because it's less aggressive. And yeah, anyway, the whole thing's crazy. Eventually I'll do a podcast where I explain it and hopefully the smoke will have cleared and hopefully I will not be on the board. But unfortunately,
are you wanting to get out of that role?
Yeah. Well, I'm not on the board. I've just been participating in a specific effort involving prairie dogs where I'm trying to minimize the number of prairie dogs that are killed. And hence all the ethics and philosophy and the different opinions that people have. So yeah, I'm looking to finish up. Like I have a very discreet thing that I'm working on. And once that's complete, I'm not required to do anything else, but I have put myself in a position where like I'm communicating well within the group, which is a bad thing if you don't want to participate. Do you have any tips?
I think you're in. You're going to have a hard time getting out of it, I think. I don't know that I really have any tips. I feel like the HOA, at least in my experience, is a very micro example of our current political, you know, ecosystem.
Sure.
And like you said, it's there'll be a suggestion that'll come in from a neighbor, and there'll be such opposing ideas on how we can either handle it or whether or not we should accept or deny. And it's just crazy. It takes so long to get anything done. And of course, we only meet once a month, and then the next month will come up, and where you end up talking about the same topic for like 6 months before we take action. And then it takes another several months before that action closes. I mean, it's just volunteers. It's all volunteers. And I guess we're all doing the best that we possibly can, but it can be a little frustrating.
Right. And we could do a whole podcast where we just talk about HOAs and like invite people on from across the world about their HOAs. But I think what you just said is what a lot of people are forgetting. I'm operating. This is not always true, but I'm operating that like everyone is trying to do their best based on whatever their ethics and philosophy and their experience and all this stuff. Like, I don't think anyone is specifically malicious. They might be. And then I have to observe what's happening, and maybe they are malicious, but most of the time it's whatever their background is, or incompetence, or an accident, or personalities, or a combination of all of them, right? Or and other external factors. But I'm usually operating as like, no one's trying to be a complete asshole. It's just happening.
So, that's how they come across, for sure.
Yeah. And I can't shut up about it, but the other part is so much happens on like social media or email and not in person. So it's really hard for people to like hash things out or reach an agreement or negotiate or whatever, because they're reading past each other, or someone treats their neighbors like a random social media post comment or whatever, like a YouTube commenter. So you end up with like some pretty volatile comments, and then emotions are high, even if it could have been like a very simple seeing each other on the street, waving at each other like, hey, water your grass every now and then, or whatever the issue is. So.
Right.
All right. I'll shut up. Thank you.
No problem.